following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It's Friday. Yay! You know, last week I said we made it to a Friday, and then I sort of joked about, well, some of us did. And then Saturday, you know, we know what happened last weekend. And I actually happened to hear a rebroadcast of the beginning of my Friday show where I said, oh, we made it to a Friday. You know, good on us. At least some of us made it to a Friday. And I'm listening to it and my stomach just dropped because too many of us didn't make it through the week. So, you know, words matter. Words really matter. I try to start every show with a comedy bit. And today's a really busy show, just so you know, so I'm going to rush through. So much going on today. So the comedy bit, instead of having a pre-produced video or song that I'm going to play for you, I'm going to read something that I found yesterday on Facebook. Somebody had retweeted or reposted something that Tommy Lee of Motley Crue posted, I think, on Twitter a couple of days ago. Now, it turns out that I've learned since I reposted this that Tommy Lee is not the original author of this particular diatribe that I'm about to share with you. Oh, I found the name of the person. I wonder if I put it in my show sheet today. I make myself a list of notes, and I always I wind up okay, I did find it. I don't give myself enough credit. The person who originally posted this screed, today's comedy bit, did so on Facebook July 17th, 2018. And it's an antique shop, Soiled Doves Rosendale is the name of the Facebook page where this post originated. Tommy Lee is retweeted it out, as I said, 2 days ago, and it's getting a lot of attention and for good reason. So I read this thing yesterday and was just in hysterics. I just laughed out loud, literally. So I posted it to Twitter and to Facebook, and oh my God, the right-wing trolls who've come out of the closet just freaking out, heads on fire. Or is it hair on fire? How, whatever. So apoplectic because of what this says. And I never felt compelled to say, it's a joke. It's a joke. Get a fucking life. So anyway, with no further ado, I should have had a musical bed to run under this. I actually went looking for a Motley Crue song that I could stand, and I couldn't find one. So just hum to yourself. Or don't, because this really needs no musical accompaniment. Okay, so here is today's funny to end the week. You ready? And it comes by way of a post, a social media post, again, put out a couple of days ago by Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, but originally posted by Soiled Doves Rosendale. Ready? Here we go. You Trumpsters better pray that liberals never gain control of the White House again, because we are going to pay you back so fucking hard for all of this shit. Planned Parenthood's on every corner. We're going to repaint Air Force One pussy hat pink and fly it over your beloved Bible Belt 6 days a week, tossing birth control pills, condoms, and atheist literature from the cockpit. We're going to tax your megachurches so bad, Joel Osteen will need to get a job at Chick-fil-A to pay his light bill. Speaking of Chick-fil-A, we're buying all those and giving them to any LGBTQ person your sick cult leaders tortured with conversion therapy. Have fun with the new menu, you bigoted fucks. Try the McPants. It's a boiled, unseasoned chicken breast that all you have to eat in the closet that you... Sorry. It's a boiled, unseasoned chicken breast that you have to eat in the closet with your mother. Sorry, I blew the punchline here. But it continues. We're going to gather up all of your guns, melt them down, and turn them into a gargantuan metal mountain emblazoned with the face of Hillary Clinton. All parks will be named... All parks will be renamed Rosa Parks as soon as possible. We're replacing Confederate... I'm really screwing this up. Sorry. We're replacing Confederate statues with Black Lives Matter leaders and Mexican immigrants. Every single public school will be renamed after a child that was kidnapped by this regime. And after we fumigate the White House, we're repainting the whole thing rainbow. Fox News will be taken over and turned into a family refugee shelter. We're turning Hannity's office into a giant unisex bathroom with changing tables and free tampons. And every single time a Trumpster complains about any of the changes, we're adding an openly gay character to a Disney movie. I think it's hysterically funny. You know, I almost wish that I hadn't blocked all the trolls who came tweeting at me over the past, you know, almost 24 hours since I posted that thing, because some of them are really, really funny. But again, I blocked them, so it's not worthy of the, you know, thing. Anyway, I've tweeted that out. I've Facebooked it. I couldn't say it better myself. There you go. And yes, it's a joke. I mean, sure, do I want to Planned Parenthood on every corner? Wouldn't be a bad idea. Would I like to spray paint Air Force One pussy hat pink and fly it over your beloved Bible Belt 6 days a week, tossing birth control pills, condoms, and atheist literature from the cockpit? You betcha. By the way, speaking of religious nuts, and we're going to get into it in a little bit, because Jeff Charlotte is on the program today. This video came to my attention via Sarah Silverman, and for good reason. This guy who's speaking that I'm going to play for you, just because I worry about the religious nuts in this country, I think organized religion is dangerous, to put it lightly. And so many of these religious sects, I will call them, are really dangerous. And so we're going to get into that. Again, Jeff Charlotte, author of The Family, whose book has been turned into a Netflix series, joins us in just a couple of minutes. You know what? I'm going to save this other thing for next week, because this will last forever. And we're short on time. And let me tell you why we're short on time. We have coming up in the second half hour, Shahid Buttar. Shahid Buttar is running for Congress. He's primarying Nancy Pelosi for her congressional seat. I'm so impressed with this guy, so I invited him on the show. So he'll join us in the second half hour. But first, it was yesterday. I was, you know, doing my early morning reading and checking out Twitter, and I followed Jeff Charlotte, who is a great author, professor at Dartmouth, you name it. Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family, who I've interviewed for years and years, found out that the Netflix series based on his books, The Family and C Street, was a new 5-part series on Netflix that premieres today. So I couldn't think of anyone better to invite on the show than Jeff Charlotte. Wow, mouth is just not working today. So hopefully I'll do better when I speak with Jeff. Take it away, Nicole. Joining us on the line now is, a man of whom I am in awe. Jeff Charlotte is an associate professor of literary journalism at Dartmouth, a contributing editor for Harper's and Rolling Stone, and the author of a number of great books, including The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, which has just been adapted as a 5-part series for Netflix, premiering Friday, August 9th. Jeff Charlotte, first of all, welcome back to the show and congratulations. This is great news.
Thanks, Nicole. It's always good to be it's always good to be with you on the show.
Well, it's great to talk to you. And I hadn't heard much about this series. I guess we could call it a mini series. It's 5 episodes on Netflix. Was it kept quiet on purpose?
Yeah, that was Netflix's approach. They came to me a few years ago and were interested in telling a story about sort of religion in the public square, and had sort of decided that the family, or the fellowship as it's known, was really a big lens through which to do that story. And at the time, I have to say, I was skeptical, having written about this organization. It's the oldest, it's the most influential, and it's the most secretive Christian conservative, you could say Christian right organization in Washington. I said, I don't know how you're going to do. I was able to work from an archive, 600 boxes that they had dumped at the Billy Graham Center in Wheaton, Illinois. But, you know, you can't take your cameras into their meetings. I said, I didn't know how you're going to do this. Director Jesse Moss, working with Netflix, and really found the visual language. And so they worked quietly for several years, and were even actually able to get some family members to sit for interviews, and they wanted to wait until it was ready, and here it is. And so now we can be public about it.
Awesome. Well, and Jesse Moss will be calling in at some point, we think, while we're talking, so we'll just bring him into the conversation, but I wanted to get started with you. So the series, from what I've read, it seems like it's sort of a hybrid between a documentary and a docudrama, because parts of it are dramatized while there's an actor playing you as you describe what's going on. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's a very strange experience as an actor playing a 30-year-old me with more hair. And I'm 47 now, which, you know, that's how long I've been around this, working on this story. And so the first episode, we have a mix. We have a lot of interviews. Jesse Moss, there's a lot of new reporting in this story. So, you know, I published my books, The Family and Sea Street, in 2008, 2010.
Wow.
This brings it right up to the present. So, you know, this is what this powerful Christian right organization is doing in the age of Trump, the Trumpocene, as I call it. And, you know, looking... here's an example. In 2010, I closed my book, C Street, and I said, well, you know, the congressman I'm talking about in this book, then Governor Mark Sanford, then Senator John Ensign, had been brought down by sex scandals,
right,
which the family had helped cover up. But these guys are, you know, they're not going to be the presidential timber that they had hoped to be. But who will the family's candidate in the future be? And I said, this is my one claim to fame of getting a political prediction right. I said, maybe in 2010, it will be, or in 2016, it will be a little-known Indiana congressman named Mike Pence going to the White House.
Oh,
so I didn't get it quite right, you know. He's not at the top of the ticket, but he's pretty close. And that's the story that Netflix is telling, is bringing it into the present. But they wanted to give that full scale, too. So the first episode includes a dramatization of the chapter with which I opened the book, about as a 30 years old going to live in this house for younger men being groomed for leadership in this organization called Ivanwald. It's part of this cluster of houses they have in a wealthy cul-de-sac outside of Washington, Arlington, Virginia, all built around this mansion called the Cedars. And I lived for just a little less than a month with these other young men. And we wanted to tell that story because it was important for us to help the viewer both see the ways in which this organization is fundamentally anti-democratic. And by that, I'm not casting any aspersions. Right from their beginning, they began with what they thought was the insight. In the 1930s, they said, they looked around at the world, they looked at fascism and communism, and they said, you know what? Democracy is done. We need a greater strength. So we want to tell that story, but we also want to tell a story. How does someone get involved in this?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is not a group of people sitting in the back room smoking cigars and cackling about how to do evil. They all think they're doing good, even as they really seek out and subvert and undermine democracy and seek out and endorse and promote authoritarianism. How do they get to that point? So the dramatization, telling the story of how I, as a young man, got involved, allows us to do that. And it gives us, I mean, I want to emphasize, I'm not the director of this. This is a Netflix production. But what they've done is, I think, and I can say this, you know, you can praise work that's not your own. I think what they've done is a work of art.
Oh, good. I can't wait to see it. And it's an important work as well, because, again, it is based on your investigative work. Now, Jeff Charlotte is with us, author of The Family and C Street, among others. But the Netflix series is based on those two books, which is sort of two parts of the same story. But do you go back to the beginning of the family? For instance, this was such a secretive organization. I mean, we've all heard about, you know, the Bilderbergs and all these other secretive alleged governmental organizations. But this is real. This was kept a secret. It was established, the family, in 1935 to oppose FDR's New Deal and the spread of trade unions. Was that the purpose of the formation?
Yeah. Began 1935. The founder's man named Abraham Verady, and he believed that God came and spoke to him directly. He believed this is not an interpretation. He believed that direct communication that Christianity had been getting it wrong for 2,000 years and focusing on the poor, the suffering, the down and out. None of that, said God to Abraham Verady. He says, your mission is to focus on those whom he would come to call the up and out, the wealthy, the powerful, the elites, those whom he would call key men. And I do mean men. This is a gender progressive organization. And he believed that by helping to give more power to the already powerful, he would bring about God's kingdom on earth. So we tell that story. We tell that story about how they began as this anti-labor organization, about how after World War II, they went international by seeking out former Nazis, high-ranking war criminals whom they could whitewash, and they say to them, look, if you will switch out your allegiance from the Führer to the Father, then we have a place for you in the new rising American power. And their growth over the years, bringing in members of Congress into every corner of the developing world until now, here we are. And, you know, the scary thing about this story right now, and because you and I have talked about this story for years, mm-hmm. is that the family over the years would cultivate these authoritarian strongmen and as heads of state around the world. We talked about Uganda, where the family group there wrote something called the Kill the Gays Bill, which is exactly what it sounds like, death penalty for homosexuality, working with the dictator you were in the 70s. United States always had access to the most high ranks of power, but we still had, you know, we were holding on to democracy. Now in Donald Trump, that most impious of souls, we have the kind of strong man that the family looks for. They say, you want to understand Jesus, here's who you look at. I'm quoting here. This is going to sound extreme, but this is their language. This is their metaphor for Jesus. It's not the line of the land. They say, Hitler, Lenin, Mao, Pol Pot, Osama bin Laden. That's the strength that Jesus exemplifies, and that's the strength we look for in leaders. It doesn't matter if they're pious. It matters if they're willing the deal. And that's what Trump is all about. Trump is the guy they have been waiting for.
And this is just fascinating, because we've had some deeply religious presidents, right? I think George W. Bush was one. I don't know what his affiliation was with the family. I learned from you, Jeff Charlotte, that Hillary Clinton was a member.
A friend. They would call a friend.
Okay.
But yes, she did have a relationship with them. I mean, if you want to do religion in Washington, you're going through them. That's not my characterization. That's characterization of another Christian right leader, Reverend Rob Schenck, who has his own sort of stable of congressmen to whom he ministers. But he envies the family for their access and power. But yeah, Trump is something else. There's one of Trump's evangelical advisors is a man named Lance Waldow, and he wrote a book you probably haven't heard of, but it was a bestseller in Christian right circles. It was called God's Chaos Candidate, and it was basically the case for Trump to Christian conservatives who might say, you know, the rank and file aren't thinking in political terms. They're saying, like, here's how we make a deal with this guy. And Lance Waldow's writing, he tells a story of going to a man who he described as almost certainly Doug Coe, the longtime leader of the family. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, how do we work with politicians, especially some of these guys who are, you know, what the family calls imperfect vessels? Coe tells a parable. He said, now look again at Christ. Who does he come to a minister to? He says, he's not as interested in the sheep as he is in the wolves. And you're saying, wait a minute, what? The wolves? Well, that's true, of course. We know that Christ If you're a Christian, you believe that he came and he spoke to the tax collector and the prostitute as well, right? Mm. That's not what the family means. They mean the elites, the wolf. He says to seek out not just the wolves, but the leader of the pack, the guy whom Coe calls the Wolf King. And you go to the Wolf King and you say, look, you're pretty powerful. I can bring to you. And you almost sort of like imagine Mike Pence making this deal. I can add to you the power of Jesus. And how is that power of Jesus? It's the power of the biggest turnout in evangelical votes for Donald Trump in American history, more than Ronald Reagan, more than W. And he has paid them back in kind with the most fundamentalist administration in U.S. history. And as a Christian right will gladly say, we've gotten more done in these few years than under any other administration.
And what's so astounding is the religious right's embrace of Donald Trump, who is, I can't get into his head, but I've studied people enough to know he doesn't have religion. The man is a shyster and a fake and a phony on every front. I mean, just look at the first time he spoke at Liberty University and talked about 2 Corinthians. Look, I'm an atheist Jew, and I even know that he got that wrong. Yet, I guess because he's willing to do the bidding of the religious right, in this case, the family, they embrace him with everything they've got. It just blows my mind that all...
Well, look, I mean, the family, you look at some of the clients over the years, Suharto, the late dictator of Indonesia, who killed 1 million of his own citizens and was described himself as a Muslim. Saad Barre, the dictator of Somalia, who wreaked, you know, almost biblical destruction on that country, described himself as a Quranic Marxist, but he was willing to trade prayers for Jesus with, by the way, Senator Chuck Grassley, still in power now, in exchange for U.S. military aid. So if you can work with guys like that, you can work with Trump. And I think it's actually a thing for those of us who might see ourselves as progressives, liberals, leftists. We've got to move past this sort of thing where we sort of say, oh, but that's hypocritical. And here's 2 reasons. One, yeah, and so what? Because there it is, they're in power. And 2, we've got to recognize that the Christian right, look, they're political people. They work in the world too. They understand... they understand the means to an end. And Trump understood it too. Trump's pretty clear. He says, I made a deal with the evangelicals. I'll give them what they want. You know, I'll give them the global gag rule. We're going to push back on abortion. I'm going to give them the justices. We're going to push. We're going to slam public education over places no one's paying attention to. Housing and urban development under Ben Carson, another associate of the family. We're going to start making religious tests for public housing. We are going to transform government. I'll give them that in exchange for their support. And everybody's sitting there and saying, that's a pretty good deal. And when you look at that, suddenly it doesn't become such a mystery how they can support Trump. They're getting a great deal. Getting a great deal.
And not only that, I mean, with the help of Mitch McConnell, they've packed the courts and changed the tenor of the Department of Justice in the United States for generations to come. I mean, Trump has been able to get more judges confirmed to the federal bench than probably any other president in history. This was all by design of Mitch McConnell, and I guess with the backing of the religious community, who has a lot more juice than we are led to believe, if you don't do the digging that you, Jeff Charlotte, have done.
They have the juice and the juicer right now. I mean, they are the game. This is even more so, I would argue, than corporate power now,
right,
which, you know, you start to see there's a sort of an uneasiness. You know, look, this is a sort of interesting moment where we have an authoritarian leader who, I just came from taping a talk show this morning, and the other guests on were CEOs of 2 major corporations, and they were there talking because they are terrified of Trump's immigration rules, because, of course, that's bad for business.
Sure.
For them. But there's a bigger authoritarian picture here. And again, I think the question, and Jesse Moss puts it really well, the director of this series on Netflix, The Family, and I have to plug it. It's coming. It'll be, you can see it on August 9th, all
yes.
5 episodes. Puts it like he came to my books and he said, well, this is really terrifying. What is how does this explain Donald Trump? How does this explain how the Christian right can be in business with him? And I think when we start looking at that, this is almost a ritual declaration of the death of the Christian right that happens in the American media. And it's happened every 5 years. You go all the way back to 1925 and the Scopes monkey trial. Mm. That's the trial where, remember, we had about evolution.
Sure.
You know, maybe you've seen the movie Inherit the Wind. And after that trial, which, by the way, the fundamentalists won, nonetheless, the American press said fundamentalism is ridiculous. It's over. No one ever going to pay attention to that again. And they've been declaring that every 10 years ever since. They declared it throughout Obama. If you go back, look at the press. Obama's president, while the Christian right clearly has no strength anymore. The family is the key to understanding how they stick around. The Bible thumpers that we see on TV, they rise and fall. The family endures. They've been there for a long time. And if you're a figure like Trump and you're looking to make a deal, that's who you've got to talk to.
So do they still have the houses around Washington, D.C., where influential people, even members of Congress, live?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They've got a lot of real estate. I wrote about their house on C Street. Mm-hmm. A number of congressmen were living where they were. Senator John Ensign, who was having an affair, was sort of living where Congressman Chip Pickering was actually meeting his mistress, who was a lobbyist. He later became a lobbyist actually there in this house that was registered as a church, so it didn't have to pay tax.
Oh, my God.
I sat in on some meetings there that were just kind of astonishing. Are congressmen still living there? I don't know. One of the interesting things about the series is that Jesse Moss, the director, was able to get a number of leaders of the family to sit for interviews, and yet they still will not embrace small-D democratic transparency. That's just the basic rules of the game. They won't tell us where they live. So we know that the family still has their great mansion in Arlington called the Cedars, where they host heads of state. We know that the family is still paying for members of Congress to go overseas and represent not us, U.S. taxpayers, but this Jesus thing, as Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma puts it, or Bob Atterholt. Republican Congressman Robert Atterholt, we see in this series traveling around Romania, representing the United States as he pushes Romania to pursue an anti-LGBTQ agenda.
Oh, my God.
To achieve there what they cannot achieve here. We see they go overseas, they come here. We also tell in this story Maria Butina.
Yes.
Listeners may remember her as the
sure.
Russian spy.
Yep.
One of her main forums was the family's only public event, the National Prayer Breakfast, which she got involved with at the Moscow Prayer Breakfast, one of their events that they hold for the Russian elite. Current family leader Doug Burley is the son-in-law of the former leader, who died in 2017, so now he's sort of taking on a mantle of leadership, and a longtime Russian hand, organizer of prayer breakfast for the Russians. And the family is facilitating the entrance in the United States of some elite Russians who are actually legally banned from entering the United States. So they're helping those guys come for the National Prayer Breakfast. And in their wake comes Maria Butina, this Russian spy, for whom we read in the affidavit, they arrange access to American power.
Oh, my goodness. This is bigger than we knew. So, Jeff Charlotte, again, The Family, which premieres on Netflix. It's a 5-part series. Friday, August 9th, it'll be available. So we'll probably binge it over the weekend. So you don't have to wait a week to see each subsequent episode, which is the beautiful thing about streaming services like Netflix. But so it's based on your two books, The Family and C Street. And as you mentioned, C Street was published in 2010. So obviously a lot has transpired since. And I love the fact that you bring it up to date and include Trump in this. Is there another book coming to bring us the information that we'll see in The Family on Netflix?
Not from me. I have another book coming out soon in February called This Brilliant Darkness, but it's on other subjects,
okay,
including police brutality and that kind of thing. But the interesting thing, since I published those books, what I was hoping would happen is that other media would sort of, you know, pick up pick up the torch and do the reporting, and whether that's great shows like yours that have just stayed focused on the story, or local press in Oklahoma, the state paper did a tremendous investigation of Senator Inhofe's misuse of tax dollars to do his evangelizing, or historians and scholars. There's a historian named Kevin Cruz did a terrific, that Princeton did a terrific history of the relationship between the National Prayer Breakfast and corporate interests. New York Times, after ignoring this story for so long, just did some good reporting on the use of the National Prayer Breakfast as a sort of a behind-the-scenes lobbying festival. Hmm. So, I mean, that's the way I like to see journalism working. One person tells a story, but it's not my story. I don't know the story. Right. And in that sense, that's why it's great that Netflix has now picked this up and taken it further than I ever could have.
Now, we were expecting... Oh, and I think he might be there right now. Hold on. Very quickly, do we have Jesse on the line? Is that you, Jesse?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. So that's great, because Jeff and I have been talking, and we have a couple minutes left. So Jesse Moss is a Sundance Award-winning director and cinematographer who is the director of this five-part series, that The Family, for Netflix, that premieres on Friday. So Jesse, how did you get involved in this project? Did you go to Jeff and say, I want to put this on television? How did it come about?
Yeah, I read Jeff's book. I had not read it when it came out. Just about 2 years ago, I read it, both books, The Family and C Street.
Right.
And I just about fell off my chair. This was not a story that I knew. I had not heard about The Fellowship, which surprised me. Here was this incredible story hiding in plain sight. Jeff found it. And I thought, is there potential to make this a documentary series? It seemed challenging. For one, The Fellowship has not really cooperated with the media ever.
Nope.
But I took the idea to the Jigsaw, Alex Gibbons' company, and to Netflix, both of whom I had just worked with, and said, is this something we can try to do? And they got behind the project, and we, inspired by Jeff's work, we set out to update the story to see what The Fellowship was doing now, and to explore the question of their relevance today. That was a big motivation for me, is this group still active? How influential do they remain? How can we build on Jeff's work?
So thank you for doing this, because I think it's such an important story. I've been discussing it with Jeff since The Family was published over, 11 or 12 years ago. And the fact that it's updated to include Donald Trump, because we've entered an even more dangerous era, I think. So thank you for the work. One last question for you that I'm fascinated, and I'll see it, you know, this weekend. The combination of documentary and docudrama, is this something you came up with to tell the story? How did this format come about?
I think Jeff's work and the story of The Fellowship presented some challenges to us. How could we translate this into a documentary series? Mm-hmm. And there are no rules or orthodoxy for how we could tell the story. And one of the things that captivated me about Jeff's book was his own experience as a young man going to live at Ivanwald and becoming a part of the Fellowship. And I wanted to bring that experience to life in our series. And I felt that the best way to bring the audience in was the way Jeff brought us in, was to dramatize that. Obviously, it's Jeff's point of view. It's a subjective experience. But with the support of Netflix, we were able to do that, and I think a really ambitious and I think very engrossing way for the audience. And I think much the same way as Jeff's account in the book provokes a set of questions, in the series, in the first episode, we go in kind of at ground level. We cannot really make sense of what this world is, and it then unpacks itself in the subsequent episodes. So, and I think audiences want to be challenged. They want to be shown these stories in all of the complexity that they demand. And I think that we live in a very exciting time for nonfiction storytelling. And so I like the idea that we could combine kind of rigorous investigative journalism. We could combine cinema verite filmmaking, which I love to do. We could do some historical archive work. We could also bring in the tools of dramatization. And I think I have great faith in the audience to find their way through this story and arrive at an understanding of what the fellowship is based on the different techniques.
And it's a really important story that you're telling, especially at this point in American history. Director Jesse Moss and the wonderful Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family and C Street, and a number of other books, Sweet Heaven When I Die, and on, and the new one that's coming. Look forward to that. Jeff Charlotte, Jesse Moss, thank you both. And I'm so excited. The Family premieres on Netflix Friday, August 9th, and, you know, binge away. Thank you, guys. There you go. Jeff Charlotte and Jesse Moss, the director. And somebody in the chat room asked, what time does it premiere on Netflix? It's there today. Today is August 9th. So it is it's whenever you want to watch it. That's the beautiful thing about Netflix and Hulu and these on-demand streaming services is you watch when you want to. Because they're there on demand. So they went live, I guess, at probably at midnight last night. It's called The Family, and again, on Netflix, available whenever you want to watch it, starting today. All right, we're going to change gears. Let me just first give you a program note that this evening, I am once again filling in for Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen on the Bradcast. So you can go to bradblog.com. to download it. It'll be available, I don't know, in a few hours. Because once I'm done with this show, then I move over and do that one. It'll air on the Progressive Voices Network at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific. We, of course, are on 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific on Progressive Voices. You will hear that Jeff Charlotte interview again if you listen again, because it's that important. This is really such an important piece of work. All right. Now, to change focus here. If you've listened to this show for any amount of time, you know that I've been really critical of Nancy Pelosi of late, especially. Number one, I believe she's dragging her feet on the question of impeachment. I'm not happy about it. And two, you know what? She's off in Europe somewhere, which I understand. That's what speakers and members of Congress do on August recess. But we are in the midst of a national emergency. We had two mass shootings with 30 people killed in a 13-hour period. We are in a national emergency. Now, Nancy Pelosi sent a letter to Donald Trump and sent a letter to Mitch McConnell, asking them to bring the Senate back into session to pass or to take up the two bills that the House passed in February dealing with background checks and gun control. But she has no plans to call the House back from vacation because she's, I guess, too busy on vacation. There are many of us who believe Nancy Pelosi served her purpose. And now it's time for her to move on. And go figure, there's a great challenger right there. I was going to say waiting in the wings, but he's not waiting in the wings. Shahid Buttar is running for Congress, primarying Nancy Pelosi from the 12th District of California. Let me tell you a little bit about Shahid. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being with us today. Are you there?
Thanks so much
for
having me
on. Hi. So you've been reading your bio, a legal advocate, national nonprofit leader, grassroots organizer, and a movement musician, and a Stanford law graduate. You're sort of a Renaissance man, I guess, for the 21st century. Most recently, you built the National Grassroots Network for the Electronic Frontier Foundation as its director of grassroots advocacy. And I got to thank you for your work there, because you were on the front lines of the fight for net neutrality, which you know, is still sort of in limbo, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, we haven't restored net neutrality at the federal level. We did pass a number of state bills, including one in San Francisco, that are currently locked up in litigation. But from net neutrality to the movement to end mass surveillance to the movement to impose civilian oversight over surveillance at the local police level, I've had a chance through my work at EFF to be engaged in a number of the fights for our digital rights over the last several years.
Awesome. So you've got a real wide-ranging, I hate that term, background. You've done a little bit of everything. You left the Bay Area after graduating law school at Stanford and moved to D.C., where you've been working. Are you back in San Francisco now for your campaign?
Yeah, I lived in San Francisco for three different points, and I've lived there since 2015, and I lived there from 2008 to 2010, and I lived there in the early 2000s. So yeah, I moved back to San Francisco in 2015 after my second stint in D.C. I had 2 5-year stints in D.C. I led a national nonprofit for 6 years. I filed the first marriage equality case in the state of New York. I was the principal spokesperson for the counter-inaugural demonstrations greeting President Bush's second selection. To serve in the White House. So I've had a chance to both promote the progressive movement in the courts, to champion its interests in the policy sphere, and also to mobilize street resistance, not just to the Trump administration and not even just to the Obama administration, but back going into the Bush administration 20 years ago. So I've had a chance to build the progressive movement in a lot of different ways on a lot of different fronts. And when you know how I've done a little bit of everything, the only half-joking nudge I put on that is that I've done a lot of everything. But I'm very eager to put that experience to use representing my proud city in Washington.
I love it. By the way, I should mention your website is Shahid, S-H-A-H-I-D, for, F-O-R, change, .us. Shahidforchange.us. And you're on Twitter.
Shahid for change.
Shahid. I'm sorry, Shahid.
Yeah.
For change.
No
I should have asked. And Buttar is the correct pronunciation of your last name?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, you know.
Shahid Buttar. So what made you decide to primary Nancy Pelosi? Was there one thing or did it just build up over the years?
I'd say that I have a great many accumulated frustrations. You know, I've seen the concerns of our communities, whether the movement for Black Lives or the immigrant rights movement or the Occupy movement or the movement for peace and justice in the face of U.S. militarism and wars for profit. I've seen our concerns fall on deaf ears repeatedly. And frankly, I've seen Speaker Pelosi help the right wing from taking evidence of CIA torture and sweeping it under the rug, to funding Bush's wars, to funding Obama's surveillance, to funding Trump's concentration camps. And I'm basically tired of being misrepresented. Last year in 2018, she underwent a prolific stunt reading for 8 hours on the House floor letters from DREAM Act students while unfortunately selling out immigrants in a negotiation. And it was seeing the pandering to interests that Speaker Pelosi unfortunately undermines in fact. I basically had enough of watching that from the sidelines and decided that if that's how my city is going to be represented in Washington, I at least want to go down swinging.
And good for you. And on behalf of a lot of listeners that I've heard from since I announced a few days ago that you were going to be joining us, thank you from them as well for stepping up. You know, it's disheartening. That's an understatement. Today marks the 5th anniversary of the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
Right.
5 years. And yet we're still seeing police officers shooting unarmed people, mostly, you know, young men of color, but others as well, and getting away with it. And I've seen no action. Is this something that that you think Nancy Pelosi should have acted on in some sense?
Absolutely. And I can list about 10 different ways. In fact, I could list about 30 different ways in which she could have taken action and hasn't. Criminal justice reform happens to be the area where our campaign has developed the most rigorous and expansive policy proposal that I've seen yet, presenting an intersection of the movement's demands, that is the movement for Black Lives and the movement for immigrant rights, in one place. And I was working in Washington when, under a Democratic Congress, the Congress failed to pass the End Racial Profiling Act. It almost passed 20 years ago with the support of the Bush administration until the 9/11 attacks knocked it off the congressional agenda, and it's never been seen since. I thought it was a profound failing of the Obama administration that after, as a state senator in Illinois, championing and seeing into law a set of historic racial profiling restrictions, President Obama abandoned that effort in Washington. Speaker Pelosi hasn't supported meaningful measures to ensure impunity, to ensure accountability for state violence and to end the era of unaccountable impunity. But I would say this, in a country that embraces impunity for state violence, unapologetic arbitrary profiling, mass surveillance, indefinite detention, even impunity for torture, the idea that we claim to live in a land of the free and a home of the brave is frankly silly. And it terrifies me. I mean, I'm an immigrant to the United States. My family came here seeking freedom and opportunity. I'm not willing to look away and let the principles that have long made our country great die on my watch. And I fear that Speaker Pelosi is so bought into the Beltway consensus and the partisan dynamic in Congress that she hasn't seen fit to, for instance, show up to, just to give an example, the easiest thing Congress could do is create a national registry of cops who have killed unarmed people so that when a police officer gets fired from one department, they don't just get hired by the next one. That's how Tamir Rice died in Cleveland.
Right.
You know, a police officer who'd been fired from another department. The police chief in that department said this man should not work as a police officer anywhere. He shows up in a park and kills a 12-year-old within 30 seconds who's, you know, playing with a toy gun. That's a perfect example of Congress being asleep at the switch. And we can't take it anymore. As a country, we need to have members of Congress who are willing to stand up for basic constitutional rights, who are willing to stand up for government accountability. That's exactly why I'm running.
Great. If you're just joining us, our guest is Shahid Buttar. He is primarying Nancy Pelosi in California's 12th district for her congressional seat. She may be Speaker of the House, but she is just a member of Congress like the 434 others who have to run every 2 years. Shahid is primarying her. You know, I have so many frustrations with Nancy Pelosi, and it goes back to before she first got the gavel 10 years ago or so, when with George W. Bush, who was guilty of war crimes, lying us into these wars that we're still fighting for whatever reason. And Nancy Pelosi, before she ever got the gavel, proclaimed impeachment is off the table. And now she's kind of doing it again, although her hand is being forced, because I think the members of her caucus are rising up against her. Now a majority of them have said it's time for an official impeachment inquiry. And I guess in her latest, she had to sign off on this lawsuit to get, what's his name? The White House counsel, Don McGahn, to testify before the Judiciary Committee. She had to sign off on it, and they used the language of impeachment. Where do you stand on this impeachment argument and how Nancy Pelosi is handling it?
I've been beating the drum on impeachment since the president first took office. I think he's been impeachable from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't even point to any of the fact-intensive investigations that have happening. The violations of the Emoluments Clause, that's the clause in the Constitution that prohibits federal officials from enriching themselves at taxpayer expense. That's all this president ever does. And I wrote an op-ed promoting impeachment about 3 months ago. It was cited by the nation's foremost constitutional law authority. His name's Lawrence Tribe. He's a retired Harvard Law School professor. And he shared our piece with 500,000 followers on Twitter and cited it as the basis for why he changed his attitude about impeachment before he had opposed it. When we wrote our op-ed, he said, now is the time, and here is why. And a few of the things that we argued in that piece were simply that, A, impeachment is a constitutional imperative to which every member of Congress swears an oath. They swear an oath that they will defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. There is no question, I think in anybody's mind, that the greatest threat to our Constitution is our criminal president.
Mm-hmm.
And that shouldn't surprise anyone because, again, his impeachable acts are legion and they grow by the day. You know, setting aside the fact that impeachment is a constitutional imperative, Speaker Pelosi pretends that we can't pick up votes in the Senate, which I think is a profound concession, a resignation, frankly, without a basis. We might think that the Senate is a hostile place for impeachment proceedings, and it certainly is true, but it's that attitude reveals a very unfortunate denigration of red state progressive activists and Democratic Party activists in red states and purple states who can force Republican senators, particularly those who are up for re-election in 2020, to make hard choices between the president's future and their own. And if we put those party activists in red and purple states in a position where they can force their senators to show up for accountability, I think we can flip some votes in the Senate. Which is all that is to say that the calculus that the speaker is making is incorrect. It's irrelevant because it is a constitutional imperative. And at the end of the day, if we don't impeach this criminal president, we are effectively inviting any future president to commit any number of offenses, not just against the Republic and not just against the American people, but against anyone. And we are basically declaring a precedent here in not impeaching that will leave Congress toothless. And as a constitutional lawyer, it is absolutely critical to me that we guard the separation of powers. A big part of that is ensuring that Congress exercises its prerogatives and does the hard work of checking and balancing criminal activity in the White House. That's exactly what Speaker Pelosi has refused to do.
Exactly. Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And I had a feeling you were going to say that because, again, you are a constitutional law professor. I guess you worked with Lawrence Lessig as a teaching assistant in constitutional law, right?
That's right. I've never been a professor, okay. But I was a teacher assistant for Lawrence Lessig when I was a student 20 years ago.
Okay. Well, so I mean, as a layperson, I don't have any legal training, but the whole thing that I'm, up in arms about is the fact that she is basically letting him get away with, murder, not literal murder, but upending the
indirectly.
Rule of, yeah, upending the rule
it,
of
30
law.
30 people just died last week.
That's true.
Prompted by attacks that were inspired by the president's hateful, vile rhetoric.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. And regardless, look, I understand that the Republicans in the Senate likely won't vote to convict at this point in time. But once the hearings begin in earnest, once we get Don McGahn on the stand and all the facts come spilling out, hopefully a few of them will have an attack of conscience or realize that it's the future of the nation that's at stake here and the future of Congress. Because as it stands now, with Donald Trump telling White House staffers and former staffers just to ignore congressional subpoenas, this is upending everything this country is based on, isn't it?
Absolutely. Another way to put that is that Speaker Pelosi reduces to a partisan fight what is ultimately an attack on our republic. And that is a dangerous abdication of, again, a constitutional responsibility to defend the Constitution. Already, Republicans who are serving federal elected office, I'm thinking of House Member Justin Amash, have defected from their own parties over recognizing the criminal culpability of our president. And I don't think it will take red senators necessarily having epiphanies of their conscience. I think, frankly, their own careerism will force them to vote to impeach the president if we let the train leave the station. The House has to initiate for the Senate to then be put in the hard position of making tough choices. And if we put especially Republican senators who are up for re-election in 2020, and there are many of them, and I think any one of them, if they vote not to impeach the president, will effectively be signing the death warrant for their careers. I mean, they will find themselves out of office if only because they will be facing the uproar their voters, their constituents. And this is
as
a great place where constituents can pull a lever. They can wield influence, but only if the House takes action. And that's the danger of Pelosi's reticence to proceed. She's basically throwing a wet blanket on accountability. She's throwing a wet blanket on the progressive base. And again, if the impeachment train doesn't leave the station in the House, we know it will never arrive in the Senate. But there is a fighting chance to secure Republican senator votes for impeachment if we force the hearings, the sustained news cycles that they will present, the activism of Democratic Party activists in red and purple states can unlock and shift where the ball stands at the moment.
Now, Shahid Buttar, again, primary Nancy Pelosi in California's 12th district, have they, I'm guessing you don't do polling. It's number one, early. And number two, I know it's tough in single congressional campaigns to get the money to do polling. Are you getting any indication? How's the support going? How's the campaign going?
It's been remarkable. In the last month, we raised as much money as we did in the three prior months put together.
Nice.
We've been getting media attention and endorsements that I didn't get last year in 2018. I ran in 2018 to replace Pelosi as well. And in 3 months without any media attention, we got as many votes as Representative Ocasio-Cortez did in her primary. We ran at the same time on opposite sides of the country. She broke through and I didn't.
Right.
I learned a few things watching their campaign. And in the month since we launched for 2020, we've been endorsed by Linda Sarsour, the co-chair of the Women's March.
Right.
We've been endorsed by Sean King. You mentioned the uprising in Ferguson.
Yep.
He's one of the most prolific journalists that have been covering the movement
for
Black Lives. He's been
endorsed
by a former president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Matt Gonzalez, another member of the former member of the Board of Supervisors, Eric Marr. And as those endorsements continue to roll in, I have a great deal of confidence that over the next year, between the media attention we're getting, the formidable ground game that we've established, and there are almost daily mobilizations in San Francisco, some of which are drawing, you know, more than a dozen participants. And we have signs up all over the city. You know, our campaign is increasingly hard to miss when you're on the ground in San Francisco. And with the benefit of the year we still have before the general election, I have a great deal of confidence that we can liberate the seat, especially if Bernie Sanders is at the top of the ticket in the November 2020 general election.
Wouldn't that be awesome? So I take it you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, as am I.
Absolutely.
He'd be a great president. I worry, though, because the hits that he takes from the corporate media is astounding. There is a Bernie blackout. The way he's treated by MSNBC and CNN is it would be laughable if it wasn't so serious, because I think they do real damage. And it's not only them. The New York Times, for example, a couple of weeks ago, did a big story on all the candidates that were at, I think it was an NAACP convention, and they mentioned everyone who was there except for Bernie Sanders. It's
who got the biggest round of applause.
Exactly.
While he was there. I mean, that's the irony.
Yep. Yeah. Right.
I think that play's not going to work. They tried that in 2016. And Bernie, you know, we saw the results. He still forced the questions about how our nation's going to spend our resources, and are we going to throw working families and future generations under the bus or not? And he fought that battle to the mat without any media attention. He is clearly the front runner in the current race. If only if you look at the number of individual donors he has more than several of the other top campaigns put together.
Yep.
And this idea that Biden, who frankly is a joke, I mean, the idea that Joe Biden, who's never won a single state primary despite running for the president many times, is going to beat Donald Trump is, frankly, it's ridiculous. And we shouldn't even, like, consider the possibility for more than, you know, a second. The only reason Biden's even in the race is that he was the vice president under the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. People forget that he was the rightward check. He was the check and balance within the administration to constrain its progressive sensibilities. You know, there's no reason that Joe Biden's in the race. And so I see him as, you know, effectively cannon fodder for Bernie. I would say the same thing that with respect to, for instance, Senator Harris or, you know, any of the other also ran. These are people who only look progressive by yesterday's standards. And there is one candidate in the presidential race who has stood for working families and stood for future generations his entire career. There is one candidate who made sure that establishing healthcare as a matter of right within the United States would be at the top of our legislative and discursive agenda. That's Bernie Sanders. I'm very proud as a Muslim congressional candidate to support our first Jewish president, recognizing that people of all faiths, of all backgrounds, of all persuasions, we all share interests in protecting and expanding human rights. I want to establish a human right to healthcare. I want to establish a human right to housing. I want to establish a human right to food. These are simple, basic principles. We have the money for all of these things, particularly once we reclaim it from the Pentagon. And that's a big part of, you know, I could go on there,
oh,
the amount of fraud and waste that pervades military procurement. But these are some of the reasons why I'm running and why I also share your inspiration to support Bernie Sanders.
Oh, awesome. I love hearing you talk. And by the way, we have two chat rooms going during this live program, one on YouTube and one on NicoleSandler.com. And you've gotten a whole lot of new fans here today. Somebody just asked, who would your ideal vice presidential pick be for Bernie?
I think that Liz Warren might be the, and I've described her as the one ring to rule them all, you know, sort of in a reference to Tolkien. I think she is the voice who is best poised to heal the rift between the warring factions across the Democratic Party.
Uh-huh.
You know, on the one hand, I do think that Bernie is the more committed voice for a paradigm shift, and that's why I want him in the White House as the president. I think among the current nominees, Liz Warren is the closest to him in terms of a substantive vision.
Yep.
There are others, you know, Nina Turner is somebody, you know, state senator from Ohio. I think she would be an excellent vice presidential choice should Bernie move in that direction. The reason I cite Senator Warren in particular, people forget how she got to the Senate. And, you know, she has a reputation for being, you know, center left, the sort of, you know, furthest left among the candidates who
right.
is willing to, you know, embrace the current corporate capitalist paradigm. And the way she got to the Senate, I think, is revealing. She spent her career as a Harvard law professor promoting particularly consumer protections in the financial industry, especially in the context of bankruptcy. When she successfully got the Congress to create the agency that she'd been advocating the creation of, that's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and the Senate denied her confirmation to lead the bureau that she created.
Yep.
She went back to Massachusetts. She took out a Republican senator. She came back and she's like, now what?
Yeah.
You know, you want to mess with me now? And that's an incredibly powerful story. I wish, frankly, her campaign talked more about that, because
no
it indicates she's got a strong spine. Now, the knock on Liz Warren, and I, you know, have to be honest, I share this. The idea that she was registered as a Republican for years while claiming not to be political and working in the policy sphere is exactly a reflection of so many things that are wrong in Washington. You have a bunch of people in Washington who pretend that their jobs aren't political because they work in policy. But the fact of the matter is that any work in policy is inextricably political, particularly when it's constrained by political choices to defer to, for instance, runaway corporate resource extraction or a military-industrial complex that is, you know, destroying freedom of conscience and the rights of particularly vulnerable minorities across the country and the world. You know, when we think about the political deference to established inertia, to established interests, particularly industrial interests, that constrain policy possibilities, that to me reflects Liz Warren's, I hate to use the word here, but at least for some part of her career, she was unfortunately co-opted.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one thing we can say for Senator Sanders. He has never been co-opted. He has always stood on the right side of history. He has been willing to look political reality in the face and say, F you, I'm not going to do what you told me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to vote my conscience. And that's the kind of leader that we need in the White House, particularly at an age when we are struggling with outright kleptocracy and the deference of a supposed opposition to it.
Absolutely. Shahid Buttar, again, what a pleasure it is to meet you and talk with you. I'm so impressed with everything you say. How can my listeners help you?
Folks can check us out online. They can kick us contributions, shout us out on social media. Our website is shahidforchange.us, and we're on all the major social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Shahid for Change.
You got it. I will put links on my blog at NicoleSandler.com along with the podcast of today's show. And thank you again for doing this, for standing up for the right reasons. Go get them. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Thank you, Nicole. Great to talk with you, and I appreciate the support. Keep up the great work.
You too. Thanks so much. Bye-bye. All right, and with that, we are done. It's the weekend, so go out and have a great one. There's a bunch of Walmart protests tomorrow. I'll be at the Walmart in Coral Springs, Florida, right by Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Maybe I'll see you there. Keep the faith, everyone. See you Tuesday. Bye.